worst, then I can plan for it. But if I'm surprised, we're fucked. And if we're fucked, you're fucked. Because I get to fly away in my G4. I took a breath, looked him in the eyes. I cheated on Amy. I've been cheating on Amy.
Okay, with multiple women or just one?
No, not multiple. I've never cheated before.
So, with one woman?
Bolt asked, and looked away, his eyes resting on a watercolor of a sailboat as he twirled his wedding band. I could picture him phoning his wife later, saying, just once I want a guy who's not an asshole. Yes, just one girl. She's very...
Don't say girl. Don't ever say girl, Bolt said. Woman. One woman who is very special to you. Is that what you were going to say?
Of course it was.
You do know, Nick, special is actually worse than okay. How long?
A little over a year.
Have you spoken to her since Amy went missing?
Yes, on a disposable cell phone. And in person once. Twice, but...
In person?
No one has seen us, I can swear to that. Just my sister. He took a breath, looked at the sailboat again.
And what does this... What's her name?
Andy.
What is her attitude about all this?
She's been great until the pregnancy announcement. Now I think she's a little on edge. Very on edge. Very, needy is the wrong word.
Say what you need to say, Nick. If she's needy, then...
She's needy, clingy, needs lots of reassurance. She's a really sweet girl, but she's young, and it's been hard, obviously. Tanner Bolt went to his minibar and pulled out a Clamato. The entire fridge was filled with Clamato. He opened the bottle and drank it in three swallows, then dabbed his lips with a cloth napkin.
You will need to cut off, completely and forever, all contact with Andy, he said.
I began to speak, and he aimed a palm at me.
Immediately.
I can't cut it off with her just like that, out of nowhere.
This isn't something to debate. Nick! I mean, come on, buddy. I really got to say this? You cannot date around while your pregnant wife is missing. You will go to fucking prison. Now, the issue is to do it without turning her against us, without leaving her with a vendetta, an urge to go public, anything but fond memories. Make her believe that this was the decent thing. Make her want to keep you safe. How are you at breakups?
I opened my mouth, but he didn't wait.
We'll prep you for the conversation the same way we'd prep you for a cross-exam, okay? Now, if you want me, I'll fly to Missouri. I'll set up camp, and we can really get to work on this. I can be with you as soon as tomorrow if you want me for your lawyer. Do you?
I do. I was back in Carthage before dinner time. It was strange. Once Tanner swept Andy from the picture, once it became clear that she simply couldn't stay, how quickly I accepted it. How little I mourned her. On that single 2-hour flight, I transitioned from in love with Andy to not in love with Andy. Like walking through a door. Our relationship immediately attained a sepia tone. The past. How odd that I ruined my marriage over that little girl with whom I had nothing in common except that we both liked a good laugh and a cold beer after sex. Of course you're fine with ending it, Go would say. It got hard. But there was a better reason. Amy was blooming large in my mind. She was gone, and yet she was more present than anyone else. I'd fallen in love with Amy because I was the ultimate Nick with her. Loving her made me superhuman. It made me feel alive. At her easiest, she was hard because her brain was always working, working, working. I had to exert myself just to keep pace with her. I'd spend an hour crafting a casual email to her. I became a student of Arcana so I could keep her interested. The Lake Poets, the Code Duello, the French Revolution. Her mind was both wide and deep, and I got smarter being with her. And more considerate. And more active. And more alive. And almost electric. Because for Amy, love was like drugs, or booze, or porn. There was no plateau. Each exposure needed to be more intense than the last to achieve the same result. Amy made me believe I was exceptional, that I was up to her level of play. That was both our making and undoing, because I couldn't handle the demands of greatness. I began craving ease and averageness, and I hated myself for it. And ultimately, I realized, I punished her for it. I turned her into the brittle, prickly thing she became. I had pretended to be one kind of man and revealed myself to be quite another. Worse, I convinced myself our tragedy was entirely her making. I spent years working myself into the very thing I swore she was, a righteous ball of hate. On the flight home, I'd looked at Clue 4 for so long, I'd memorized it. I wanted to torture myself. No wonder her notes were so different this time. My wife was pregnant. She wanted to start over, return us to our dazzling, happy aliveness. I could picture her running around town to hide those sweet notes, eager as a schoolgirl for me to get to the end, the announcement that she was pregnant with my child. Wood. It had to be an old-fashioned cradle. I knew my wife. It had to be an antique cradle. Although the clue wasn't quite in an expectant mother tone. Picture me. I'm a girl who is very bad. I need to be punished, and by punished, I mean had. It's where you store goodies for anniversary 5. Pardon me if this is getting contrived. A good time was had here right at sunny midday. Then out for a cocktail, all so terribly gay. So run there right now, full of sweet sighs, and open the door for your big surprise. I was almost home when I figured it out. Store goodies for anniversary 5. Goodies would be something made of wood. To punish is to take someone to the woodshed. It was the woodshed behind my sister's house, a place to stow lawnmower parts and rusty tools, a decrepit old outbuilding, like something from a slasher movie where campers are slowly killed off. Go never went back there. She'd often joked of burning it down since she moved into the house. Instead, she'd let it get even more overgrown and cobwebbed. We'd always joked that it would be a good place to bury a body. It couldn't be. I drove across town, my face numb, my hands cold. Go's car was in the driveway, but I slipped past the glowing living room window and down the steep downhill slope, and I was soon out of her sight range. Out of sight of anyone. Very private. Back to the far back of the yard, on the edge of the tree line, there was the shed. I opened the door.
No, 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 no.
Part 2. Boy Meets Girl.
Amy Elliott Dunn. The Day of. I'm so much happier now that I'm dead. Technically missing, soon to be presumed dead. But as shorthand, we'll say dead. It's been only a matter of hours, but I feel better already. Loose joints, wavy muscles. At one point this morning, I realized my face felt strange, different. I looked in the rearview mirror, dread Carthage 43 miles behind me, my smug husband lounging around his sticky bar as mayhem dangled on a thin piano wire just above his shitty, oblivious head, and I realized I was smiling. Ha! That's new. My checklist for today, one of many checklists I've made over the past year, sits beside me in the passenger seat, a spot of blood right next to item 22. Cut myself. But Amy is afraid of blood, the diary readers will say. The diary, yes. We'll get to my brilliant diary. No, I'm not. Not a bit. But for the past year, I've been saying I am. I told Nick probably half a dozen times how afraid I am of blood, and when he said, "I don't remember you being so afraid of blood," I replied, I've told you so many times. Nick has such a careless memory for other people's problems. He just assumed it was true. Swooning at the plasma center, that was a nice touch. I really did that. I didn't just write that I did. Don't fret. We'll sort this out. The true and the not true and the might as well be true. Item 22, cut myself, has been on the list a long time. Now it's real, and my arm hurts. A lot. It takes a very special discipline to slice oneself past the paper cut layer, down to the muscle. You want a lot of blood, but not so much that you pass out, get discovered hours later in a kiddie pool of red with a lot of explaining to do. I held a box cutter to my wrist first, but looking at that crisscross of veins, I felt like a bomb technician in an action movie. Snip the wrong line, and you die. I ended up cutting into the inside of my upper arm, gnawing on a rag so I wouldn't scream. One long, deep, good one. I sat cross-legged on my kitchen floor for 10 minutes, letting the blood drizzle steadily until I'd made a nice, thick puddle. Then I cleaned it up as poorly as Nick would have done after he bashed my head in. I want the house to tell a story of conflict between true and false. The living room looks staged, yet the blood has been cleaned up. It can't be Amy. So the self-mutilation was worth it. Still, hours later, the slice burns under my sleeves, under the tourniquet. Item 30, carefully dressed wound, ensuring no blood has dripped where it shouldn't be present. Wrap box cutter and tuck away in pocket for later disposal. Item 18, stage the living room. Tip ottoman. Check. Item 12, wrap the first clue in its box and tuck it just out of the way so the police will find it before dazed husband thinks to look for it. It has to be part of the police record. I want him to be forced to start the treasure hunt. His ego will make him finish it. Check. Item 32. Change into generic clothes, tuck hair in hat, climb down the banks of the river and scuttle along the edge, the water lapping inches below, until you reach the edge of the complex. Do this, even though you know the Taverers, the only neighbors with a view of the river, will be at church. Do this because you never know. You always take the extra step that others don't. That's who you are. Item 29. Say goodbye to Bleeker. Smell his little stinky cat breath one last time. Fill his kibble dish in case people forget to feed him once everything starts. Item 33. Get the fuck out of Dodge. Check, check, check. I can tell you more about how I did everything, but I'd like you to know me first. Not Diary Amy, who is a work of fiction. And Nick said I wasn't really a writer, and why did I ever listen to him? But me, actual Amy. What kind of woman would do such a thing? Let me tell you a story, a true story, so you can begin to understand. To start, I should never have been born. My mother had 5 miscarriages and 2 stillbirths before me, one a year in the fall as if it were a seasonal duty, like crop rotation. They were all girls. They were all named Hope. I'm sure it was my father's suggestion, his optimistic impulse, his tie-dyed earnestness. We can't give up hope, Mary Beth. But give up hope is exactly what they did, over and over again. The doctors ordered my parents to stop trying. They refused. They are not quitters. They tried and tried, and finally came me. My mother didn't count on my being alive, couldn't bear to think of me as an actual baby, a living child, a girl who would get to come home. I would have been Hope 8 if things had gone badly. But I entered the world hollering, an electric neon pink. My parents were so surprised they realized they'd never discussed a name, not a real one, for a real child. For my first 2 days in the hospital, they didn't name me. Each morning, my mother would hear the door to her room open and feel the nurse lingering in the doorway. I always pictured her vintage, with swaying white skirts and one of those folded caps like a Chinese takeout box. The nurse would linger, and my mother would ask without even looking up, "Is she still alive?" When I remained alive, they named me Amy, because it was a regular girl's name. A popular girl's name, a name 1,000 other baby girls were given that year, so maybe the gods wouldn't notice this little baby nestled among the others. Mary Beth said if she were to do it again, she'd name me Lydia. I grew up feeling special, proud. I was the girl who battled oblivion and won. The chances were about 1%, but I did it. I ruined my mother's womb in the process. My own prenatal Sherman's March. Mary Beth would never have another baby. As a child, I got a vibrant pleasure out of this. Just me, only me. My mother would sip hot tea on the days of the Hopes' birth deaths, sit in a rocker with a blanket, and say she was just taking a little time for myself. Nothing dramatic. My mother is too sensible to sing dirges. But she would get pensive. She would remove herself. And I would have none of it, needful thing that I was. I would clamber onto my mother's lap, or thrust a crayoned drawing in her face, or remember a permission slip that needed prompt attention. My father would try to distract me, try to take me to a movie or bribe me with sweets. No matter the ruse, it didn't work. I wouldn't give my mother those few minutes. I've always been better than the Hopes. I was the one who made it. But I've always been jealous, too. Always. 7 dead dancing princesses. They get to be perfect without even trying, without even facing one moment of existence, while I am stuck here on Earth, and every day I must try, and every day is a chance to be less than perfect. It's an exhausting way to live. I lived that way until I was 31. And then, for about 2 years, everything was okay, because of Nick. Nick loved me, a 6-0 kind of love. He loved me. But he didn't love me, me. Nick loved a girl who doesn't exist. I was pretending, the way I often did, pretending to have a personality. I can't help it. It's what I've always done. The way some women change fashion regularly, I change personalities. What persona feels good? What's coveted? What's au courant? I think most people do this. They just don't admit it. Or else they settle on one persona because they're too lazy or stupid to pull off a switch. That night at the Brooklyn party, I was playing the girl who was in style. The girl a man like Nick wants. The cool girl. Men always say that as the defining compliment, don't they? She's a cool girl. Being the cool girl means I am a hot, brilliant, funny woman who adores football, poker, dirty jokes, and burping, who plays video games, drinks cheap beer, loves threesomes and anal sex, and jams hot dogs and hamburgers into her mouth like she's hosting the world's biggest culinary gangbang while somehow maintaining a size 2. Because cool girls are above all hot. Hot and understanding. Cool girls never get angry. They only smile in a chagrined, loving manner and let their men do whatever they want. Go ahead. Shit on me. I don't mind. I'm the cool girl. Men actually think this girl exists. Maybe they're fooled because so many women are willing to pretend to be this girl. For a long time, cool girl offended me. I used to see men, friends, co-workers, strangers, giddy over these awful pretender women, and I'd want to sit these men down and calmly say, "You are not dating a woman. You are dating a woman who has watched too many movies written by socially awkward men who'd like to believe that this kind of woman exists and might kiss them." I'd want to grab the poor guy by his lapels or messenger bag and say, "The bitch doesn't really love chili dogs that much. No one loves chili dogs that much." And the cool girls are even more pathetic. They're not even pretending to be the woman they want to be. They're pretending to be the woman a man wants them to be. Oh, and if you're not a cool girl, I beg you not to believe that your man doesn't want the cool girl. It may be a slightly different version. Maybe he's a vegetarian, so cool girl loves seitan and is great with dogs. Or maybe he's a hipster artist, so cool girl is a tattooed, bespectacled nerd who loves comics. There are variations to the window dressing, but believe me, he wants cool girl, who is basically the girl who likes every fucking thing he likes and doesn't ever complain. How do you know you're not cool girl? Because he says things like, "I like strong women." If he says that to you, he will at some point fuck someone else. Because "I like strong women" is code for "I hate strong women." I waited patiently, years, for the pendulum to swing the other way, for men to start reading Jane Austen, learn how to knit, pretend to love Cosmos, organize scrapbook parties, and make out with each other while we leer. And then we'd say, "Yeah, he's a cool guy." But it never happened. Instead, women across the nation colluded in our degradation. Pretty soon, cool girl became the standard girl. Men believed she existed. She wasn't just a dream girl, one in a million. Every girl was supposed to be this girl. And if you weren't, then there was something wrong with you. But it's tempting to be cool girl. For someone like me, who likes to win, it's tempting to want to be the girl every guy wants. When I met Nick, I knew immediately that was what he wanted. And for him, I guess I was willing to try. I will accept my portion of blame. The thing is, I was crazy about him at first. I found him perversely exotic, a good old Missouri boy. He was so damn nice to be around. He teased things out in me that I didn't know existed. A lightness, a humor, an ease. It was as if he hollowed me out and filled me with feathers. He helped me be cool girl. I couldn't have been cool girl with anyone else. I wouldn't have wanted to. I can't say I didn't enjoy some of it. I ate a moon pie. I walked barefoot. I stopped worrying. I watched dumb movies and ate chemically laced foods. I didn't think past the first step of anything. That was the key. I drank a Coke and didn't worry about how to recycle the can, or about the acid puddling in my belly, acid so powerful it could strip clean a penny. We went to a dumb movie, and I didn't worry about the offensive sexism or the lack of minorities in meaningful roles. I didn't even worry whether the movie made sense. I didn't worry about anything that came next. Nothing had consequence. I was living in the moment, and I could feel myself getting shallower and dumber, but also happy. Until Nick, I'd never really felt like a person, because I was always a product. Amazing Amy has to be brilliant, creative, kind, thoughtful, witty, and happy.
We just want you to be happy.
Rand and Mary Beth said that all the time, but they never explained how. So many lessons and opportunities and advantages, and they never taught me how to be happy. I remember always being baffled by other children. I would be at a birthday party and watch the other kids giggling and making faces, and I would try to do that too, but I wouldn't understand why. I would sit there with the tight elastic thread of the birthday hat parting the pudge of my under chin, with the grainy frosting of the cake bluing my teeth, and I would try to figure out why it was fun. With Nick, I understood finally, because he was so much fun. It was like dating a sea otter. He was the first naturally happy person I met who was my equal. He was brilliant and gorgeous and funny and charming and charmed. People liked him. Women loved him. I thought we would be the most perfect union, the happiest couple around. Not that love is a competition, but I don't understand the point of being together if you're not the happiest. I was probably happier for those few years, pretending to be someone else, than I ever have been before or after. I can't decide what that means. But then it had to stop, because it wasn't real. It wasn't me. It wasn't me, Nick! I thought you knew. I thought it was a bit of a game. I thought we had a wink-wink, don't-ask-don't-tell thing going. I tried so hard to be easy, but it was unsustainable. It turned out he couldn't sustain his side either. The witty banter, the clever games, the romance and the wooing. It all started collapsing on itself. I hated Nick for being surprised when I became me. I hated him for not knowing it had to end, for truly believing he had married this creature, this figment of the imagination of a million masturbatory men, semen-fingered and self-satisfied. He truly seemed astonished when I asked him to listen to me. He couldn't believe I didn't love wax-stripping my pussy raw and blowing him on request, that I did mind when he didn't show up for drinks with my friends. That ludicrous diary entry. I don't need pathetic dancing monkey scenarios to repeat to my friends. I am content with letting him be himself. That was pure, dumb, cool girl bullshit. What a cunt. Again, I don't get it. If you let a man cancel plans or decline to do things for you, you lose. You don't get what you want. It's pretty clear. Sure, he may be happy. He may say you're the coolest girl ever. But he's saying it because he got his way. He's calling you a cool girl to fool you. That's what men do. They try to make it sound like you are the cool girl so you will bow to their wishes. Like a car salesman saying, "How much do you want to pay for this beauty?" when you didn't agree to buy it yet. That awful phrase men use, "I mean, I know you wouldn't mind if I..." Yes, I do mind. Just say it. Don't lose, you dumb little twat. So it had to stop. Committing to Nick, feeling safe with Nick, being happy with Nick, made me realize that there was a real Amy in there. And she was so much better, more interesting, and complicated, and challenging than cool Amy. Nick wanted cool Amy anyway. Can you imagine finally showing your true self to your spouse, your soulmate, and having him not like you? So that's how the hating first began. I've thought about this a lot, and that's where it started, I think.
Nick Dunn, 7 days gone. I made it a few steps into the woodshed before I had to lean against the wall and catch my breath. I knew it was going to be bad. I knew it once I figured out the clue. Woodshed. Midday fun. Cocktails. Because that description was not me and Amy. It was me and Andy. The woodshed was just one of many strange places where I'd had sex with Andy. We were restricted in our meeting spots. Her busy apartment complex was mostly a no-go. Motels show up on credit cards, and my wife was neither trusting nor stupid. Andy had a MasterCard, but the statement went to her mom. It hurts me to admit that. So the woodshed, deep behind my sister's house, was very safe when Go was at work. Likewise, my father's abandoned home. Maybe you feel guilty for bringing me here. I must admit it felt a bit queer, but it's not like we had the choice of many a place. We made the decision. We made this our space. And a few times, my office at school. I picture myself as your student, with a teacher so handsome and wise. My mind opens up, not to mention my thighs. And once, Andy's car pulled down a dirt road in Hannibal after I'd taken her for a visit one day, a much more satisfying reenactment of my banal field trip with Amy. You took me here so I could hear you chat about your boyhood adventures, crummy jeans, and visor hat. Each clue was hidden in a spot where I'd cheated on Amy. She'd used the treasure hunt to take me on a tour of all my infidelities. I had a shimmer of nausea as I pictured Amy trailing oblivious me in her car, to my dad's, to Go's, to goddamn Hannibal, watching me fuck this sweet young girl, my wife's lips twisting in disgust and triumph. Because she knew she'd punish me good. Now, at our final stop, Amy was ready for me to know how clever she was. Because the woodshed was packed with about every gizmo and gadget that I swore to Boney and Gilpin I hadn't bought with the credit cards I swore I didn't know anything about. The insanely expensive golf clubs were here. The watches and game consoles. The designer clothes. They were all sitting here, in wait, on my sister's property, where it looked like I'd stored them until my wife was dead and I could have a little fun. I knocked on Go's front door, and when she answered, smoking a cigarette, I told her I had to show her something, and I turned around and led her without a word to the woodshed. "Look," I said, and ushered her toward the open door.
"Are those? Is that all the stuff from the credit cards?"
Go's voice went high and wild. She put one hand to her mouth and took a step back from me, and I realized that just for a second, she thought I was making a confession to her. We'd never be able to undo it, that moment. For that alone, I hated my wife. "Amy's framing me, Go," I said. "Go. Amy bought this stuff. She's framing me." she snapped to. Her eyelids clicked once, twice, and she gave a tiny shake of her head as if to rid herself of the image. Nick as wife killer. Amy's framing me for her murder, right? Her last clue, it led me right here, and no, I didn't know about any of this stuff. It's her grand statement, presenting Nick goes to jail. A huge, burpy air bubble formed at the back of my throat. I was going to sob or laugh. I laughed. I mean, right? Holy fuck, right? So hurry up, get going, please do, and this time I'll teach you a thing or two. The final words of Amy's first clue. How did I not see it? If she's framing you, why let you know? Go was still staring, transfixed by the contents of her shed. Because she's done it so perfectly. She always needed that validation, the praise, all the time. She wants me to know I'm being fucked. She can't resist. It wouldn't be fun for her otherwise. No, Go said, chewing on a nail. There's something else. Something more. Have you touched anything in here? No. Good. Then the question becomes, what does she think I'll do when I find this incriminating evidence on my sister's property? I said. That's the question, because whatever she assumes I'll do, whatever she wants me to do, I have to do the opposite. If she thinks I'll freak out and try to get rid of all this stuff, I guarantee you she has a way I'll get busted with it. Well, you can't leave it here, Go said. You'll definitely get busted that way. Are you sure that was the last clue? Where's your present? Oh, shit. No, it must be inside somewhere. Don't go in there, Go said. I have to. God knows what else she's got in store. I stepped carefully into the dank shed, keeping my hands tight by my sides, walking delicately on tiptoes so as not to leave tread marks. Just past a flat-screen TV, Amy's blue envelope sat on top of a huge gift box, wrapped in her beautiful silvery paper. I took the envelope and the box back outside into the warm air. The object inside the package was heavy, a good 30 pounds, and broken into several pieces that slid with a strange rattle as I set the box on the ground at our feet. Go took an involuntary quick step away from it. I slid open the envelope. Darling husband, now is when I take the time to tell you that I know you better than you could ever imagine. I know sometimes you think you are moving through this world alone, unseen, unnoticed, but don't believe that for a second. I have made a study of you. I know what you are going to do before you do it. I know where you've been, and I know where you're going. For this anniversary, I've arranged a trip. Follow your beloved river, up, up, up. And you don't even have to worry about trying to find your anniversary present. This time, the present will come to you. So sit back and relax, because you are done. What's up, River? Go asked, and then I groaned. She's sending me up the river. Fuck her. Open the box. I knelt down and nudged off the lid with my fingertips, as if expecting an explosion. Silence. I peered inside. At the bottom of the box lay two wooden puppets, side by side. They seemed to be husband and wife. The male was dressed in motley and grinning rabidly, holding a cane or a stick. I pulled the husband figure out, his limbs bouncing around excitedly, a dancer limbering up. The wife was prettier, more delicate, and stiffer. Her face looked shocked, as if she'd seen something alarming. Beneath her was a tiny baby that could be attached to her by a ribbon. The puppets were ancient, heavy, and large, almost as big as ventriloquist dummies. I picked up the male, gripped the thick, club-like handle used to move him, and his arms and legs twitched manically.
"Creepy," Go said.
"Stop." Beneath them lay a piece of buttery blue paper folded over once. Amy's broken kite handwriting, all triangles and points. It read, "The beginning of a wonderful new story, Nick. That's the way to do it. Enjoy." On our mom's kitchen table, we spread all of Amy's treasure hunt clues and the box containing the puppets. We stared at the objects as if we were assembling a jigsaw puzzle.
"Why bother with a treasure hunt if she was planning her plan?" Go said.
Her plan had become immediate shorthand for faking her disappearance and framing you for murder. It sounded less insane. "Keep me distracted, for one thing. Make me believe she still loved me. I'm chasing her little clues all over Christendom, believing my wife was wanting to make amends, wanting to jump-start our marriage." The moony, girlish state her notes had left me in, it sickened me. It embarrassed me. Marrow deep embarrassment. The kind that becomes part of your DNA, that changes you. After all these years, Amy could still play me. She could write a few notes and get me back completely. I was her little puppet on a string. "I will find you, Amy." Lovesick words, hateful intentions. So I don't stop to think, hey, it sure looks like I murdered my wife. I wonder why. And the police would have found it strange. You would have found it strange if she didn't do the treasure hunt, this tradition, Go reasoned. It would look as if she knew she was going to disappear. "This worries me, though," I said, pointing at the puppets. "They're unusual enough that they have to mean something. I mean, if she just wanted to keep me distracted for a while, the final gift could have been anything wooden." Go ran a finger across the male's motley uniform. "They're clearly very old. Vintage." She flipped their clothing upside down to reveal the club handle of the male. The female had only a square-shaped gap at her head. "Is this supposed to be sexual? The male has this giant wooden handle like a dick, and the female is missing hers. She just has the hole." "It's a fairly obvious statement. Men have penises and women have vaginas." Go put a finger inside the female puppet's gap, swept around to make sure there was nothing hidden. "So what is Amy saying?" "When I first saw them, I thought she bought children's toys. Mom, dad, baby, because she was pregnant." "Is she even pregnant?" A sense of despair washed over me, or rather, the opposite. Not a wave coming in, rolling over me, but the ebb of the sea returning. A sense of something pulling away, and me with it. I could no longer hope my wife was pregnant, but I couldn't bring myself to hope she wasn't either. Go pulled out the male doll, scrunched her nose, Then light bulb popped.
You're a puppet on a string.
I laughed. I literally thought those exact words too. But why a male and female? Amy clearly isn't a puppet on a string. She's the puppet master.
And that's the way to do it. To do what?
Fuck me for life.
It's not a phrase Amy used to say, or some quote from the Amy books, or...
She hurried over to her computer and searched for That's the Way to Do It. Up came lyrics for That's the Way to Do It by Madness.
Oh, I remember them, Ghost said. Awesome ska band.
Ska, I said, swerving toward delirious laughter. Great. The lyrics were about a handyman who could do many types of home improvement jobs, including electrical and plumbing, and who preferred to be paid in cash. God, I fucking hate the 80s, I said. No lyrics ever made sense.
The reflex is an only child, Go said, nodding.
He's waiting by the park, I muttered back automatically.
So if this is it, what does it mean?
Go said, turning to me, studying my eyes.
It's a song about a handyman, someone who might have access to your house to fix things or rig things. Who would be paid in cash so there's no record?
Someone who installed video cameras? I asked. Amy went out of town a few times during the affair. Maybe she thought she'd catch us on tape. Go shot a question at me. No, never, never at our house.
Could it be some secret door? Go suggested. Some secret false panel Amy put in where she's hidden something that will, I don't know, exonerate you?
I think that's it.
Yes, Amy is using a madness song to give me a clue to my own freedom. If only I can decipher their wily ska-infused codes.
Go laughed then, too.
Jesus. Maybe we're the ones who are batshit crazy. I mean, are we? Is this totally insane?
It's not insane. She set me up. There is no other way to explain the warehouse of stuff in your backyard. And it's very Amy to drag you into it, smudge you a little bit with my filth. No, this is Amy. The gift, the fucking giddy sly note I'm supposed to understand. No, and it has to come back to the puppets. Try the quote with the word marionettes. I collapsed on the couch, my body a dull throb. Go played secretary.
Oh my God, duh. They're Punch and Judy dolls. Nick, we're idiots. That line, that's Punch's trademark. That's the way to do it.
Okay, the old puppet show. It's really violent, right? I asked.
This is so fucked up.
Go, it's violent, right?
Yeah, violent. God, she's fucking crazy.
He beats her, right?
I'm reading, okay, Punch kills their baby.
She looked up at me.
And then when Judy confronts him, he beats her. To death.
My throat got wet with saliva.
And each time he does something awful and gets away with it, he says, that's the way to do it.
She grabbed Punch and placed him in her lap, her fingers grasping the wooden hands as if she were holding an infant.
He's glib, even as he murders his wife and child.
I looked at the puppets. So she's giving me the narrative of my frame-up.
I can't even wrap my brain around this. Fucking psycho.
Go?
Yeah, right. You didn't want her to be pregnant. You got angry and killed her and the unborn baby.
feels anticlimactic somehow, I said. The climax is when you are taught the lesson that punch never learns, and you are caught and charged with murder. And Missouri has the death penalty, I said. Fun game.
Amy Elliott Dunn, The Day Of. You know how I found out? I saw them. That's how stupid my husband is. One snowy April night, I felt so lonely. I was drinking warm amaretto with Bleeker and reading, lying on the floor as the snow came down, listening to old scratchy albums like Nick and I used to. That entry was true. I had a burst of romantic cheer. I'd surprise him at the bar, and we'd have a few drinks and wander through the empty streets together, hand in mitten. We would walk around the hushed downtown, and he would press me against a wall and kiss me in the snow that looked like sugar clouds. That's right. I wanted him back so badly that I was willing to recreate that moment. I was willing to pretend to be someone else again. I remember thinking, we can still find a way to make this work. Faith. I followed him all the way to Missouri because I still believed he'd love me again somehow. Love me that intense, thick way he did. The way that made everything good. Faith. I got there just in time to see him leaving with her. I was in the goddamn parking lot, 20 feet behind him, and he didn't even register me. I was a ghost. He didn't have his hands on her, not yet, but I knew. I could tell because he was so aware of her. I followed them, and suddenly he pressed her up against a tree, in the middle of town, and kissed her. Nick is cheating, I thought dumbly, and before I could make myself say anything, they were going up to her apartment. I waited for an hour, sitting on the doorstep, then got too cold, blue fingernails, chattering teeth, and went home. He never even knew I knew. I had a new persona, not of my choosing. I was average dumb woman married to average shitty man. He had single-handedly de-amazed Amazing Amy. I know women whose entire personas are woven from a benign mediocrity. Their lives are a list of shortcomings. The unappreciative boyfriend, the extra 10 pounds, the dismissive boss, the conniving sister, the straying husband. I've always hovered above their stories, nodding in sympathy and thinking how foolish they are, these women, to let these things happen. How undisciplined. And now to be one of them, one of the women with the endless stories that make people nod sympathetically and think, poor, dumb bitch. I could hear the tale, how everyone would love telling it. How Amazing Amy, the girl who never did wrong, let herself be dragged, penniless, to the middle of the country where her husband threw her over for a younger woman. How predictable, how perfectly average, how amusing. And her husband? He ended up happier than ever. No, I couldn't allow that. No, never, never. He doesn't get to do this to me and still fucking win. No. I changed my name for that piece of shit. Historical records have been altered. Amy Elliott to Amy Dunn. Like it's nothing. No, he does not get to win. So I began to think of a different story, a better story, that would destroy Nick for doing this to me. A story that would restore my perfection. It would make me the hero, flawless and adored. Because everyone loves the dead girl. It's rather extreme, framing your husband for your murder. I want you to know I know that. All the tut-tutters out there will say, She should have just left, bundled up what remained of her dignity. Take the high road. Two wrongs don't make a right. All those things that spineless women say, confusing their weakness with morality. I won't divorce him because that's exactly what he'd like. And I won't forgive him because I don't feel like turning the other cheek. Can I make it any more clear? I won't find that a satisfactory ending. The bad guy wins? Fuck him. For over a year now, I've smelled her twat on his fingertips as he slipped into bed next to me. I've watched him ogle himself in the mirror, grooming himself like a horny baboon for their dates. I've listened to his lies, 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 from simplistic child's fibs to elaborate Rube Goldbergian contraptions. I've tasted butterscotch on his dry kiss lips, a cloying flavor that was never there before. I've felt the stubble on his cheeks that he knows I don't like, but apparently she does. I've suffered betrayal with all five senses for over a year. So I may have gone a bit mad. I do know that framing your husband for your murder is beyond the pale of what an average woman might do. But it's so very necessary. Nick must be taught a lesson. He's never been taught a lesson. He glides through life with that charming Nicky grin, his beloved child entitlement, his fibs and shirkings, his shortcomings and selfishness, and no one calls him on anything. I think this experience will make him a better person, or at least a sorrier one. Fucker. I've always thought I could commit the perfect murder. People who get caught because they don't have patience. They refuse to plan. I smile again as I shift my crappy getaway car into fifth gear, Carthage now 78 miles in the dust, and brace myself for a speeding truck. The car seems ready to take flight every time a semi passes. But I do smile, because this car shows just how smart I am. Purchased for $1,200 cash from a Craigslist posting. 5 months ago, so the memory wouldn't be fresh in anyone's mind. A 1992 Ford Festiva, the tiniest, most forgettable car in the world. I met the sellers at night, in the parking lot of a Walmart in Jonesboro, Arkansas. I took the train down with a bundle of cash in my purse, 8 hours each way while Nick was on a boys' trip. And by boys' trip, I mean fucking the slut. I ate in the train's dining car, a clump of lettuce with two cherry tomatoes that the menu described as a salad. I was seated with a melancholy farmer returning home after visiting his baby granddaughter for the first time. The couple selling the Ford seemed as interested in discretion as I. The woman remained in the car the whole time, a pacified toddler in her arms, watching her husband and me trade cash for keys. That is the correct grammar, you know. Her husband and me. Then she got out and I got in. That quick. In the rearview mirror, I saw the couple strolling into Walmart with their money. I've been parking it in long-term lots in St. Louis. I go down twice a month and park it somewhere new. Pay cash. Wear a baseball cap. Easy enough. So that's just an example of patience, planning, and ingenuity. I am pleased with myself. I have 3 hours more until I reach the thick of the Missouri Ozarks and my destination, a small archipelago of cabins in the woods that accepts cash for weekly rentals and has cable TV, a must. I plan to hole up there the first week or two. I don't want to be on the road when the news hits, and it's the last place Nick would think I'd hide once he realizes I'm hiding. This stretch of highway is particularly ugly. Middle America blight. After another 20 miles, I see, up on the off-ramp, the remains of a lonesome family gas station, vacant but not boarded up, and when I pull to the side, I see the women's restroom door swung wide. I enter, No electricity, but there's a warped metal mirror and the water is still on. In the afternoon sunlight and the sauna heat, I remove from my purse a pair of metal scissors and